I put up, Wendy put up this slide for me yesterday when I reaffirmed that the National Park Service was established by Congress and the Department of Interior. This is language out of what's called the Organic Act. This is kind of the mission statement of the National Park Service. It's not been revised or anything updated, refreshed, or what have you. But if you read it, you'll see a challenge nestled in there.
What is
and it's the use and protect.
It's hard to read. Yeah, what is unimpaired for the, what's that word after unimpaired for the?
Enjoyment.
The enjoyment of future generations.
Okay, thank you.
In such a manner and by such means, whatever means, as will leave them unimpaired for the what?
Enjoyment.
The enjoyment.
Of future generations.
Yeah. You, in other words, you use it and you enjoy it. And the combination, that's some of the critics' concern these days, is overuse in some places. Like Great Smoky Mountain National Park in North Carolina is the most visited national park in the entire country.
Really?
And it's because it's located near big population centers of the East Coast.
And as I just said, the number of parks, such similar things, in Georgia, for example.
Yeah.
I read through the list, I haven't seen Okmulgee, that's the only one. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those things are not, they're nowhere near the kind of 2 or 3 day.
Yeah. Well, I subscribe to the notion that you sometimes have to work at getting to a park. It's not, a lot of us don't live next door to one. We in Albuquerque live next door to one called Petroglyphs. You've probably not heard of it.
Oh,
but it's rock art.
Yeah.
Ancient people pecked on volcanic rock, various figures and symbols. And so we're, I don't know, Jan, 8 miles, 10 miles from Petroglyph National Monument.
That's cool.
Something like that. It's kind of one of those, as Nancy said last night in the fire ecology talk, it's an urban interface park. It's right on the west edge of the Albuquerque metro area. Mm-hmm. And it's been squeezed by development. And they slammed a 4-lane highway through it, which destroyed a lot of petroglyphs.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the critics of the park would say, we need access. And so what's a few hundred petroglyphs, you know, for community traffic?
Where does 800 years, I mean, or yeah, 8,000 yeah, years old?
That's right.
You know.
That's right. So.
So they destroyed.
To put this thoroughfare through there, it's 4 lanes, 2 lanes either way, with a nice right-of-way shoulder and all of that stuff. It's a pretty big swath.
And we criticize the Taliban for destroying Buddhist statuary.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's always those kinds of threats, I think. If you think about what must have been a small village called Stahican at the head of this lake, and you looked at it 50 years ago, and you looked at it 25 years ago, and last year, you'll see that some development has occurred there. And it's kind of discovered, maybe it's regional disease, but it's been discovered, so you have a lot of traffic that rolls through there. So it's that kind of development. I'm going to kind of ramble on here, and I'll come back to my thread. But when you look at this act, and then you look at entrances to parks, what do you find at the entrance gate of a park? Many times it's a lot of development. Lodging, food service of all kinds, souvenir shops. You can just kind of run through the list of what you expect.
Lots of outdoor equipment.
Yeah.
Whatever it is you need.
Yeah. And so you can rent a canoe if you're, you know, on the Chattahoochee River near Atlanta. I was on a project at Denali National Park in Alaska years ago, and our focus was to try and help shape the development and the design of what is called the entrance to the park. In other words, work with the businesses outside the park. There's a code word that we used that you might read sometimes. It's called front country. The front country is the entrance area to a park. And Great Smokies has some of the nastiest entrances to the
Lord,
park.
I remember bumper to bumper.
I mean, Dollywood is right adjacent to the Tennessee entrance to Great Smokies. So,
and then you've got the Antunes.
It doesn't set you up for entering the park. It's really a jarring experience.
And Gatlinburg.
That's the sort of thing. And West Yellowstone has become increasingly that, I believe, on the west entrance to Yellowstone National Park.
Ironically, I was at both just 2-3 months ago, both of those parks, yes.
Well, that's the kind of thing that scares people that think that Americans and international visitors should have a good experience, and that good experience is defined by everybody as being maybe it has all the conveniences and all the comforts that I want. Mm-hmm. Others are aimed at a more down-to-earth, primitive almost experience. They might drive in and hike, because if you get 50 feet off of a parking lot in a park, you're in the backcountry almost. And most people don't do that. We love our cars and we love to do windshield touring.
What about IMAX? How many members have IMAX right outside?
Just stay home and go to IMAX.
Yeah. So, you have to go to the park, you go to the, watch it on the movie, and then
right.
So you think it's just that need, though, for,
for entertainment? Save all those
hydrocarbons and BTUs. And wait a minute, folks.
I have a counterpoint, too.
Thank you. I'll let you do it.
Go ahead.
Well, it's just that for 14 and a half years, my late husband, was in a wheelchair. The ability to take him on a paved trail through the forest was just thrilling. Far more than any hike we had taken when he was fully mobile.
Right.
So, I remember as a child the first time I went to Yellowstone, and I was shocked and disappointed that the roads were paved. As the years have gone by, if we're going to serve the whole nation, which we don't because we have this blockade of entry fees, which you're probably going to address too, but I'll get off my high horse here. But really, we need to think about inclusivity.
Mm-hmm. Well, creating access without, deteriorating. I'm talking more about the entertainment with, the movies and the gift shops and the bells and whistles, because you think of a primitive, sometimes you think of primitive as being
not a good choice of words on my part to say primitive. A kind of a fundamental basic experience, whatever that might be.
Natural.
I'll say primitive, and I recall, sadly, a couple of years I lived in LA, and how so many people out there, and of course there were 2 or 3 versions of things that didn't fit my Tennessee background. One of them was the idea of going to the desert so you could see the stars. That blew my mind because there was so much smog in Atlanta. So they add to the smog to go to the desert so they can see the stars.
You meant Los Angeles, not
LA.
Yeah, you said Atlanta. But
yeah, you
I
said.
No, I said LA, but
oh, did you? I'm sorry.
It's Los Angeles, right?
Yeah.
So that was an introduction to a mindset that never did. I never felt good with it, and I think that a lot of the folks that are in that neck of the woods, so to speak, it's not all the inner city children, but a lot of them are trapped in it. I swear the closest they're going to get is the IMAX.
Yeah. Yeah. And I circulated a flyer yesterday. This is a production to celebrate the centennial of the National Park Service.
Ah.
And there's a website, and if you want to find where it's showing nearest, where it's showing nearest to you, you can go to a website. But nevertheless, it's a Robert Redford narrated production, and I've read critiques of it as well as positive things. We just haven't yet been able to see it because we're ahead of schedule or something where it's being shown. So you've not seen it.
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it.
Years ago, I was on a long-term management planning team for the Park Service out of Denver. We were doing a management plan for Grand Canyon National Park. And we studied the park and experienced the park every which way, from floating the Colorado River to hiking into and out of the Grand Canyon and flying over it like a concessionaire does out of Las Vegas to give you air tours of the Grand Canyon. And just outside the boundary, about 12 miles from Matthew Point, which is the hello to the south rim of the national park, there's an IMAX theater. And it's showing, of course, the Grand Canyon. And one of the observations we made was that people in interviews were coming to the IMAX theater and they had the experience of almost falling into the canyon. You know how IMAX is dramatic. And then they left. They kind of checked it off as having been to Grand Canyon. Well, officially they hadn't crossed the boundary. And 12 miles up the road was the real thing. So that was one of the concerns. Now, in our management plan, we developed what you described a few minutes ago. And that is there needed to be access, ADA compliant access to points along the south rim for those who were mobility impaired so that they could get their wheelchair or whatever to a point where they too could enjoy the park. Mm-hmm. That's a requirement that some people are grumpy about, but it's an important one, and increasingly I think you would probably agree there's more and more facilities of that kind in commercial enterprises and businesses, schools, libraries, and parks than formerly was.
Absolutely, and this is proof positive right here, because people on wheelchairs for the first time ever will be able to cross that bridge and go on trails on the south side of the creek.
Okay. Yeah. I heard just this morning that the is it called 10 Mile Trail?
Yeah. That's ADA trail and will be returned.
There's some improvements that have to be made on it, but it's the standard that it's going to meet, if it hasn't already, is that.
Well, it did, right, prior to the fire?
Yes.
And then
yes, it did. And the fun thing about that, I spent a lot of time watching people come and go on that, and we don't think about the fact that there are a lot of families with small children and strollers that really are grateful for ADA.
Sure.
Accommodations.
Sure. Yeah.
And I saw that on the trail all the time.
At Zion National Park, we were talking earlier before I started this afternoon, and at the south rim of the Grand Canyon, there's shuttle buses that take visitors to drop off points, and they run on regular schedules, so you can get off, do something at that overlook or what have you, like on the south rim, get back on the bus later, and go to the next one and the next one. But they're all compliant with ADA accessibility, so that if you have a wheelchair, there's a lift, that can get you into the bus you can stay on the bus if you choose, or you can get off, because there's ramps at all those stops. So that's an important aspect of something that we as a planning team wanted to ensure the access to the South Rim would have in the future. Mainly we wanted to get people out of their cars. So we had this massive parking lot in something called a transportation center. And that's where you get out of the car and you get on the bus and you can see the South Rim. And Zion has a similar thing to that. It's very important because we love our cars in this society, and to get us out of them takes almost an explosive device. So it's important, I think, that parks increasingly do that. I think
Glacier Park does that also. Yes. On the highway to the
sunset. Going to the sunrise.
Yeah.
We enjoyed that, and we're not mobility impaired, but it was a great way to see Glacier because you could get off and spend 2 or 3 hours at one stop, and then get back on the bus and go to another. And that's kind of how we saw going to the sun, because if you're driving that highway, you're not going to enjoy the park much. You're going to be
concerned. There's a distraction. It's called driving.
That's right. And that's an important thing that I think needs to be remembered. But for every going to the sun highway, there's a little park like Fort Vancouver on the Columbia River, or Nez Perce at Spalding, Idaho, or Fort Laramie in eastern Wyoming, that they too have to have that accessibility standard met. And they've been retrofitted through the years since that became law. And that has made, I think, a difference for those who like to enjoy that. Or when I volunteered in Yellowstone a couple summers, I was in the museum, but we had a boardwalk with a ramp from the parking area so that you could get a wheelchair up on the boardwalk and roll into the museum and have a look around. It was all on one floor. There was a nice porch facing the Gibbon River and a nice meadow out in front that was enjoyed by all visitors, I think. The only hazard with that was that bison would always come around the log cabin building. And at the corners there were these logs, sort of look like this, and boy, bison loved to rub on those logs. And they itched themselves and scratched themselves and to keep people away from them, because you think they're big, slow, lumbering animals, but they aren't. They're very quick-footed, and they'd be across the Gibbon River, and people would stand across the river from them, and I'd have to go out and shoo people back, because I've seen bison cross that river in a twinkling, you know, and people are so poor in judgment that they will perch their friend or their kid next to a bison and expect to take a photo. And there's incidents every year, someone getting injured.
Because they butt, or
they butt, or they will flip you. They'll hit you with their head and flip their neck or head, and you'll just tumble up and down and land in a way that requires emergency treatment.
Helicopters.
And you get to visit West Yellowstone or Cody, Wyoming, or Livingston, Montana, where there's medical facilities. You know, there's initial treatment, of course, in the park, but some need more than what a medic can provide. All of that to say that these are things that I know in 1916, the early parks knew something about, but nothing like it's evolved in the years of the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and up to the present time. As our population has grown, I just affirmed this afternoon that our visitation in national parks now is right about 75 million a year. And Smokies, Grand Canyon, Yellowstone, and Rocky Mountain in Colorado are the highest number of visitor parks in the country, and they're the big kind of icon parks. But then you'll have a little park, and maybe they struggle to find 10,000 people coming to their little historic site, you know, in a year's time. It may be Bent's Old Fort on the Arkansas River in southeast Colorado, Fort Larned out in Kansas, in central Kansas, Pipestone in Minnesota. They're smaller parks, but nevertheless, they all have their story, and they're all authorized by Congress in the same way. So there is what's called enabling legislation, and they have to meet this Organic Act requirement, which, as you can read, is subject to some interpretation. I mean, it's like language is often viewed differently by different readers, and so you can appreciate the struggle. Well, when the Park Service was established in 1916, let me just read a few parks that were established. The new director, Mather, didn't want any dams in Yellowstone to help out Idaho farmers irrigate their land. He didn't want any dams in Glacier National Park to help Montana farmers do the same thing. He tried to purchase, and this is ongoing, purchase private property within park boundaries. There's a code word used for that. They're called inholders. And they typically been in a family for generations. There's been attempts to buy that land, but there's a very active inholders association that fights tooth and nail through legal channels to prevent the Congress from authorizing the purchase at an agreed upon price. But the linchpin to that is eminent domain, that is condemnation of property. And that's contentious, and it often involves a core of legal experts fighting one another to come up to with the appraised value of the land. And appraisers rarely, if ever, attach value to scenery or to historic resources or archaeological resources. It's highest and best use. Often that may be timber, it may be grazing, or even farming. And those are low per acre prices. And that's always a subject of sticking right here between the seller whose property is maybe being condemned and the buyer, in this case the National Park Service. Other parks established by Mather and his crew were Denali, which was once upon a time called Mount McKinley National Park, Zion, Bryce Canyon, Grand Canyon, Acadia, Great Smoky Mountain, Shenandoah, Mammoth Cave, Katmai, and Glacier Bay, both in Alaska. Those are some of the parks that came in the 20s to the National Park Service. And I may have mentioned yesterday, in the 1930s, the National Park Service, through Congressional Act, had transferred to it all of the Civil War battlefields. Previously, the predecessor of the Department of Defense was called the War Department. And the War Department managed all the Civil War battlefields. But that was all moved in the 1930s. So Antietam and Shiloh and Gettysburg, Stones River and Chickamauga, Chattanooga, all were moved to management of the National Park Service. And that's how it stands today, so that you have not only Civil War battlefields, but you have Revolutionary War battlefields. And of course, in Washington, D.C., you have many memorials that are associated with our wars. And we fought a lot of wars in this country, and so there's a lot of memorials related to World War II, the Vietnam War, the Korean War. There's still not one for World War I. It seems like it's an idea that's gaining some foothold, but it still hasn't been established. Part of the problem is that everyone wants a site on the mall in Washington, D.C., and there's not much vacant land. So that right now, for example, there's a new Smithsonian Museum of African American that's being built right adjacent to the mall in a prime location. It may open this fall. I've heard different stories about whether it's going to make it or not in terms of opening.
The magazine says it is, but.
Yeah, and there's a Museum of the American Indian that opened on the mall a few years ago. Now, I'm mixing apples and oranges here because those are Smithsonian institutions. They're not National Park Service, but the National Park Service manages the entire mall. And that includes the memorials like Lincoln and Jefferson and Washington, Vietnam, World War II, and so on. Those are assigned to the National Park Service. The Iwo Jima Monument is another example of a Park Service area, a small tract of land in Washington. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but you can see a grand variety of all kinds of sites that are not all Olympic National Park kinds of parks. There are small units of the National Park Service telling an important story of the nation's past. It could be archaeology or history or our military past, whatever. Some of the things that the new developing National Park Service did was in 1945, right at the end of World War II, there were 11 million visitors. Contrast that with 75 that I quoted, say this year, 75 million visiting parks. There were a lot fewer parks, I would be the first to admit, and our population was much smaller. In 1947, there were 25 million visitors. Just 2 years later, it jumped from 11 to 25. Well, those of you who know about American history know that the post-World War II era was a booming era of people getting back to their usual routines. You could buy an automobile that had tires on it now. They weren't rationed, you know, things of that sort. And more there was discretionary income so that Wendy's parents could load her and her siblings up and take them on a vacation. And that was, that coupled with the 40-hour work week or paid vacations or what have you, certainly increased the number of visitors to the national parks. And in 1954, it jumped to 47 million people visiting national parks. Again, a reflection, I think, of gasoline prices, discretionary income, paid vacations, and throw everyone into the station wagon and go off on a week's vacation. So those are important points hit by the parks. Well, all of this adds up to Americans wanting more and more recreation areas. And there was pressure put on the Congress to establish national lakeshores, national seashores, national recreation areas like Lake Mead down by Las Vegas. All of these kind of diluted, according to the old traditionalist National Park Service employees, the mission here on the screen. Should we be sharing our budget for a national seashore? You might think of it this way. Congress appropriates money for the National Park Service to manage the park. It's a pie. And if you bring in 10 more parks, you slice that pie differently. The pie size hasn't really increased very often, and so it's a thinner slice, and those who deserve it most among the parks would argue it's the Yellowstones and the Olympics and the Yosemites and the Great Smokies. It's not Fort Vancouver or Rosie the Riveter or Manzanar, the relocation camp of World War II and the Japanese relocation. The deserving ones are the big icon parks. Well, that's been tempered somewhat. But you'll find that view, I can assure you, if you were to interview 10 people who are employed by the National Park Service, that view is not lost. It's one that we might label today entitlement. That is, the superintendent at Yellowstone might feel entitled, whereas the superintendent at Little Bighorn may not have the leverage that a Yellowstone superintendent has.
So how do they divide the money or the budget? They
divide it by a system where you have to submit a budget proposal every year. By this time of year, that proposal is in, and you have different divisions within a park. You have law enforcement, for example. You have the interpretation, the telling of stories in the park. We call that interpretation. There's also administration. You need a financial officer. You need some staff like clerks or secretaries to do that sort of thing. Maintenance of the park is a pretty big division in every park. You know, it may be a handful of people in a small park. It may be dozens and dozens of people in a big park. So you propose the budget and you send it to a regional office. Like now, Washington State has a regional office in San Francisco. They're a part of that region. There used to be one in Seattle, but that got eliminated in downsizing of government by Vice President Gore some years ago. That was one of his big initiatives. And the regional office specialists scrutinize the budget, and they're going to streamline it and ask for justification. Why do you need a 10% increase for someone at a visitor information desk? Can't you use more volunteers? That's the message you hear these days. And so there's a finalization of the budget, and then there's what we used to call the Green Book, which is a big book full of tables listing every park in the system. That's just over 400 now. And you will see Yellowstone with its millions and millions of dollars, and you'll see Fort Vancouver with maybe $1.2 million. So that's all approved budget, but it has to fit what Congress appropriates. And you may know this well already, so tell me to stop. Every administration, every president puts together a budget for the National Park Service and makes a recommendation. The Congress puts together a budget and makes a recommendation. The two have to be reconciled. There's that give and take. You know, Congress does a little bit of give and take these days, but it's often this, unfortunately. And so you end up with a kind of compromised budget. You don't get everything you want, but sometimes there's some crumbs that fall off the table, and a small park might get 30 or 40,000 because of the crumbs that fell off the table. When I was superintendent of historic trails in Salt Lake City, a regional associate regional director in Denver called one afternoon in late August and said to me, "Can you use $30,000?" Well, the fiscal year ended 6 weeks later. Mm-hmm. It's always smart to have a couple things in the file that you can shoot in when that happens.
Because you have to spend it before mm-hmm. the fiscal year?
Yeah, it yes. has to be spent before the end of the fiscal year. And he was cleaning out the drawer, you know. And yes, we had a project in Southeast Idaho that needed that amount of money. And it was interpretive waysides that you put up at a site that explains what you're looking at. Maybe it's, in this case, it was City of Rocks National Reserve. And it told about the 49ers and the immigrants to Oregon going through City of Rocks. Well, it finished up a project that we were waiting for money for. Mm. We might have had it the next fiscal year, but it might have been 5 years later. You're in the queue, but you're not rewarded just yet. Well, that kind of thing happens from time to time. It's, to us in the field, it's kind of like a lightning strike. You know, you struck gold, and you can finish a project. So that's the budget process. Do you have any questions about that? Maybe I can answer them. Additional questions.
It's my understanding that the funding, federal funding, has declined. So yes. Maybe you could address that. And then also, I just recently bumped into the National Parks. Is it a foundation?
Yes, NPCA.
Yeah.
National Park Conservation Association. Yeah.
Do you think that sometimes, you know, if you don't have that file of wish list projects, yeah. You can't get They go to the next one. This happens in the school system for me. I feel like we just end up when we know we have to spend it. We just end up maybe it's not planful or maybe efficient or it's think of something.
Yeah. Let me illustrate your point with the Park Service example.
Yeah.
And that is, so you're in the last 2 weeks of September. The fiscal year ends September 30th. That's the government's fiscal year. You have $12,000 left and you need to spend it. Because if you don't spend it, the upper managers remember it the next time you're submitting a budget and you might be penalized.
Right.
So you spend it. And the old joke in the National Park Service, my friend, a superintendent named Marty Ott, repeated the line over and over again, and that is, as a park superintendent, buy gravel.
Buy what?
Buy gravel.
Oh, yeah, you can always use gravel.
Yeah, I was thinking about toilet paper.
There you go. You can come up with fill in the blank of many things, but my gravel was what Marty always used as an example of using up the budget, but that's exactly what a school system is. And the fact that it has to do when there's risk of losing it, it zeroes out.
But you're right, it's not just a risk of losing that money, it's a risk of them moving past
the elephant remembers the next time.
Yeah.
Right. So
is it true that the funding has declined?
Yes,
very definitely. Because you've got a larger...
Well, it's a combination of things, but here's what's been happening, and that is a lot of maintenance of parks, like it's been going around here all week long, a work week, they put it off month after month, year after year, until there's this huge, what's called maintenance backlog. And you'll hear it on the national news from time to time. The maintenance backlog, I think it's up around $11 billion now. And you're going to hear it a little bit, I think, in the current campaign for president. The Park Service doesn't make the headlines much in these presidential campaigns. We're so minuscule. But I think it will be brought up. And it'll be a complaint against both the Democrats and the Republicans that they deferred maintenance in the parks. So much so that roads are falling apart, campgrounds are deteriorating, buildings need routine maintenance. You can just go on and on and on like that. And that's the problem. You can't just keep putting it off, because otherwise, what are you doing to this Organic Act? You're not passing it along to future generations. You're passing along to them a huge debt of a maintenance backlog, and they're not going to be pleased about that. And we can say smugly, well, we'll be dead and gone by then, but that's a screwy way to run a railroad,
How do you feel about user fees? I get to
drive up to the national parks and everywhere else and show, flash my little card that I pay. I don't even remember what you, I paid
you,
for it.
You pay $10 if you have a lifetime pass.
For a lifetime, yeah.
If you're under 62, it costs you $80 a year for unlimited access to any national park. That includes the people in your car.
That to me is so backwards, because I look at all these big RVs going, I just have a little camper van, but even so, just not fair. It isn't fair. I can afford, you know, we've got the whole thing backwards.
Yeah, I don't think we'll ever see structured fees based upon your ability to pay.
Yeah.
I think
we're keeping young families out of the parks.
Yeah. And that's part of the complaint about who's going to support parks in the future.
Yeah.
We don't know what they are. They never saw them.
You're right.
That's right. And furthermore, we may have focused too much on Caucasians visiting the parks and not those of color.
Yeah.
You know, that's in the literature more and more and more. So when you couple that with a maintenance backlog and a lack of support among the citizenry for the national parks, what's going to happen to them? It's a very important question, and one that I hope you'll carry with you from this week of remembering the importance of that and talking with your friends and family about it. Maybe there's convincing arguments that you'll be able to use that results in them supporting parks. Were you in the session yesterday? One of the illustrations I used yesterday was at Saguaro National Park in Arizona, just west of Tucson. Well, there's a unit east and one west of Tucson. There's a large Hispanic population in that part of the country, but they're all over the nation. They don't much come to parks. And increasingly, their demographic is going to be the largest percentage of the population. So at Saguaro, they learn the obvious, and that is many of them can't afford to go to the park. But they did some kind of supplemental with the public bus, the public transportation system in Tucson, and ran buses back and forth to the park. And it increased their number of Hispanic visitors. But then you also have to recognize some cultural components to that. I noted yesterday that Hispanic families that Jan and I have observed love the extended family picnic. You can't just have a picnic bench that holds eight people. You need six of them. You can butt them together. You need parking for 12 cars or 12 vehicles. When a Hispanic family gathers at a park, It's kind of built around food and conversation. It's not sightseeing necessarily, or going to the museum or what have you. We need to be looking more and more at those kinds of cultural components of non-white visitors of parks that might appeal to them, and thereby you might develop a support group for the national parks in the future. So there needs to be some of that kind of thing going on.
Well, and more of the schools. I mean, schools have cut their field trip budgets and transportation budgets. We don't even have school buses in Minneapolis anymore. Yeah. When I worked in Portland, none of the kids I worked with had ever been to Multnomah Falls, which is 30 minutes from downtown Portland. And so we did a little excursion, but, you know, it's transportation. I mean, they never heard of it. They didn't know anything about the outdoor region in Portland, which brings so many people there. Sure. How do you?
And you need, as Jen and others pointed out yesterday, you need to dissipate the fears that kids have of the outdoors. Mm-hmm. That's another part of the mix in all of this. This, if you've never been camping, you know, there's wolves in those woods. You know, it's the Little Red Riding Hood phenomenon. They're going to eat you.
Yeah.
You just have to grapple with those hunger things.
Kids.
And we be more conscious of it. When we evolved out of the forest ourselves in Western Europe, we had the same problem. Only it was Western Europeans who believed that evil lay in the forest. You know, there was a troll under every bridge, and they were going to get you. Those kinds of things are important to keep in mind as we move into the 21st century further, you know, in terms of visitors to parks. It just can't be those who have lots of money to spend going to a park. It needs to be economical, it seems to me. Like you were saying about the fee structure.
Yeah.
Well, the value of that experience to children from 2 to 12 is beyond measure.
Now, I can't tell you how many dozens and dozens and dozens of people I've spoken to who recall mom, dad, and the station wagon going someplace on vacation.
Yep.
And maybe not to a park, maybe not to a national park, but it might have been to a state park, a municipal park, to grandma's house where they slept 10 in a room. You know, it's just a part of that growing up experience that you look back and despite your disgruntlement at the time, it's fun to think back over the enjoyment that you had. So
my contrast with the Los Angeles, I mean, the idea the kids still pile in the car and go to the Blue Hole Sink in my part of the world, or they go to the river.
Yeah.
And to not have the experience of what's living, oh, there's something in the water. If he's a, you know, the wrong kind of snake, you need to know which kind.
Yes.
To not have any of that experience is just beyond my, I think it destroys the perspective of the adult not to have any of that experience.
And that's what I was trying to use as a quotation yesterday about those who've been studying kind of the well-adjusted human being in the 21st century USA, is that we need the outdoors to reduce stress. Mm-hmm. That's a whole body of literature that's developing more and more. It's been studied by psychologists and physicians and other researchers doing recreation-related research that it's very important for us. It's like being at Holden Village a week. You know, out of doors is all around you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it took me a few days to kind of come to terms with the pace of things. And admittedly, I wasn't working hard like most of you. I had an easy streak, so to speak, because of my role this week. But a work camp is one where you do get in touch with nature, and though you're working hard, moving rocks or digging ditches or what have you, you find yourself away from the stresses of the world, and you didn't jump in the car 5 times in the last 3 days to run to Walgreens to get something that you think you have to have right then.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so.
Something that you haven't mentioned is, and I'm personally thrilled to see what the Wolverine fire has done, the perspective that it has come to, even though there was such risk and people felt so threatened, understandably. But at this point, there is a view as to the value, long-term value that fire has produced in the valley.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The fire ecology understanding and so forth has become very real.
Well, that awareness, I think, increasingly has to be raised among the general population, because we've been fed smoky bear so much that...
Well, we want to control everything. The light on, turn the light off.
Yeah, you're right.
And when you meet up with the natural processes and you cope with your life amongst them, it produces something very different.
Mm-hmm. I want to close with with kind of a passion of mine, because not only was the Park Service pushed toward establishing national recreation areas, lake shores and seashores and so on, but it was pushed into the business of trails. Congress passed an act in 1968 called the National Trail System Act. It provides for two categories of national trails. One, scenic trails like the Pacific Crest Trail, and others that are historic like the Oregon Trail or the Pony Express or the Summit of Montgomery, Civil Rights Trail, or the Trail of Tears like the Forester Google and the Cherokee from their homelands to Oklahoma. And the last 12 years, that's the program that I worked in. And it fit my interests and my academic background, but I was superintendent of 9 historic trails across the country. And I have a few brochures. I have enough to give to you. I'd like you to look at the spaghetti that's across the USA called National Trails. I just brought a handful, but we just have a handful of people today.
Yeah.
Did you get this the other day?
I did, okay. Yes. Thank you.
I'm going to leave some in a track rack, for Holden Village, which I must say I've enjoyed, and it's been a wonderful experience, and I thank you for inviting me. But anyway, this National Trail System is, in the case of historic trails, is not an end-to-end, you can walk the whole thing, because there's a lot of private land along the trail, but you can touch it in various places. And so, if you were to drive from here to Boise, Idaho, along Interstate 84, is it called 84? 86? 84. Okay. You cross the Blue Mountains, and Oregon has a number of waysides at rest areas where you can read about the Oregon Trail. Or you go to Fort Vancouver and you can read about the Hudson Bay Company chief factor there, John McLaughlin, aiding immigrants to Oregon who risked their lives floating down the Columbia. Or others took a safer route around Mount Hood to get to Oregon City on the Willamette River on the south edge of Portland. So there's a lot of stories related to the historic trails that are an important part of the nation's history. And that's a program that I'm intimately familiar with, and happen to be on the board of the Oregon-California Trails Association. And we, Jan and I just came from their annual convention in Idaho last week to Holden Village. So we're making a big loop here, I guess. But anyway, have a look at that. There are websites on the back side of the sheet if you want to explore for more information. And besides supporting your national parks, support your national trail system. Get out and take a hike. Or the mantra of the centennial of the National Park Service is find your park. And that means any park. Doesn't mean it has to be national. It can be your town park, your county park, your state park, whatever. But get outside. Reduce the stresses some. And with that, I'll shut up.